Colombia says it'll cease aerial raids of FARC rebel bases for 30 days. President Juan Manuel Santos made the official announcement from Bogota on Thursday. Colombia's unilateral ceasefire is the latest milestone in peace talks being held in Havana with the leadership of FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. The announcement follows significant commitments from the FARC, including cooperation in demining battlefields, cessation of child soldier recruitment, and a unilateral ceasefire that's almost entirely halted anti-government military attacks. Santos says that at the end of this 30-day period, the government will assess whether or not they should continue with the ceasefire. Some analysts say these bilateral ceasefires may be setting up Colombia for what Santos calls the, quote, definitive phase of a historic peace deal, one that'll finally put an end to the 50-plus-year civil conflict. And joining us now to talk about these very important developments that really aren't getting that much attention in the U.S. media is Adam Isaacson, Senior Associate of the Washington Office on Latin America, WOLA. He's formerly with the Center for International Policy, and he's been doing analysis and reporting and research and traveling throughout the region, focusing on U.S. drug war policy in the Andes for the better part of his adult life. Adam Isaacson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you back on. You know, I said that there hasn't been that much coverage, although there was an editorial in the New York Times earlier in the week pointing to the importance of maintaining this peace process and moving it forward. Your thoughts about the significance of this ceasefire agreement that Santos announced yesterday? It was already in the works, but Santos announced it officially yesterday.
Yeah, peace processes never seem to get a lot of media attention, but this is a pretty good news story right now. President Santos has really, this is the first time a Colombian president has said this in 31 years. President Santos said that they are not going to bomb FARC encampments. And sort of the watchword for this phase of these dialogues that have been going on since 2012 is de-escalation. They're really negotiating now simultaneously all of sort of the last agenda items, which includes, you know, what to do with the worst human rights violators, what the turning in or ceasing of using weapons is going to look like, and now also how are they gradually going to get to the state of an actual ceasefire, this was all sort of unthinkable 3 years ago, and skepticism seems to be falling away about these talks.
Yeah, and notwithstanding those positive steps, there's still the naysayers within Colombia. Yesterday, Alfredo Rangel and other opponents started saying this was a major concession to the FARC, essentially kind of giving into the FARC, reminiscent of what they perceived to be the 2000, the earlier demobilizations that took place in the previous failed peace talks in the last decade. So what are the threats or the dangers that the opposition to peace talks from people like Rangel and people like Álvaro Uribe could derail any future agreement?
Well, you know, the political center-right in Colombia is sort of lining up behind these. Colombia's conservative party is actually coming up with proposals and sitting at the at the table with political leaders trying to support this. The political extreme right, led by former President Uribe and the roughly 15% of Colombia's Senate that is from his party, they are continue to be loudly criticizing this, although some of them are willing to at least talk now to the Santos government about how to go forward. I guess the real danger, I mean, it's not working out for them first, I should say. The President Uribe was one of the most popular figures in Colombian history when he was president because his military offensive weakened the FARC. Nowadays, his approval rating in polls is in the 40s because his position seems so out of touch. But that doesn't mean that the right, the extreme right, can be can't be spoilers. They can continue to undermine President Santos. They're using, they're very good at dominating news cycles with outrageous statements inside Colombia. And then, of course, there are aspects of the or elements on the far right in Colombia that don't play nicely. They can be violent. We see threats. We see baiting of the military or elements of the military to try to act as obstacles to this. Threats against people who support the process or have worked intimately in getting it going. And the constant worry is that spoilers will use violence at key periods, especially if we do get to an accord, and you have this very tense period between the signing of an accord and its ultimate ratification, and when you start actually implementing it. That, in any peace process, is a super tense time, and that's when the spoilers can really do a lot of damage and destroy trust. And that's what worries me more than just, you know, President Uribe running his mouth on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's it's a big mouth, but certainly there has been many historical precedents of that kind of derailing that has occurred. And essentially,
right.
I mean, that's basically what we've seen throughout any effort in the 80s, 90s, and more recently to try to reach a peace agreement between the government and the FARC in Colombia. What are some sticking points right now? I know that, as you pointed out, the transitional justice issue is the phase where they're in now. What to do with so-called war criminals? Should FARC leaders see prison time? What to do with these war crimes, both from government and rebels that were carried out during this long, protracted war? And Cesar Gaviria, the former president and former OAS head, made some recent statements that were pretty interesting, where he talked about the importance of also targeting civilians who were involved and behind these atrocities that have been carried out in Colombia, within Colombia. Those civilians clearly are the ones who've supported paramilitarism and kind of the government mandate, if you will, and trying to liquidate the rebels. So where are we with that right now?
It's the hardest issue that's left to resolve at the talks. I mean, this is the one that's going to take the longest. But in my view, I think we are starting to see the outlines of what the arrangement is going to look like. I mean, the issue here is that this is the first peace process ever occurring in a country that's a signatory to the International Criminal Court. What that means is they can't just simply do what, say, El Salvador did 20 years ago and say, let's wipe the slate clean and everybody's, you know, amnestied and we move on. There has to be accountability for at least the very worst of the human rights crimes committed both by the FARC, by the military, and, as you said, by civilians who supported it. So that means that for at least perhaps a few dozen FARC members, they're going to actually have to turn in weapons and then go to something like jail if Colombia actually holds itself to this standard, and it really kind of has to.
But that derail the process?
Well, I think...
Because they're saying no jail, right?
They're saying... It's interesting when you look at what they say. Sometimes they say no jail. That might be right. They might not be in a standard Colombian jail. They certainly won't be in a facility where the Colombian government is like the jailer. But they might be in something that sort of the term of art is deprivation of liberty. They could be in some place where they can't leave. And, you know, even people in the Conservative Party in Colombia have started floating proposals for sort of farms or areas where these worst human rights violators in the FARC are someplace where they're guarded. And look, they need to be guarded for their own security, too. Mm-hmm. They'll spend several years in which they can, you know, they'll have access to the internet, they can receive visitors, they can organize, they can talk to the press. But they probably can't leave. There will be people on the perimeter, maybe some of them internationals, guarding them.
But are there guarantees for reinserting them into the political process? Because, again, we've seen the track record. Any attempts at civilian forces that have links to the FARC in one way, shape, or form. We saw the Patriotic Union in the 80s decimated by paramilitarism and state atrocities against them. What are the guarantees? Is that being part of the negotiation?
Well, I mean, the negotiators have come to 3 accords already, 4 if you count the landmines one.
Right.
And the second of those is on political participation. So they've already committed the Colombian government to a whole bunch of guarantees, including security, for the opposition, the ability to do campaigning, the ability to, there's a whole bunch of things having to do with campaign finance and access to the media. So the guarantees, at least on paper, are better. The fact that former guerrillas have had some, members of guerrilla groups that have demobilized, have had some electoral success in recent years. You've got, you know, the mayor of Bogota and others. Indicates and that there is more space than there used to be, again, this is exactly where a spoiler, somebody who really wants to bring this whole thing down, could, with a few violent acts, do so after an accord. I mean, this is where really it's the biggest argument for having internationals involved
right.
After an accord.
Well, speaking, okay, that's in terms of on the ground and security, but speaking of internationals, the U.S. has been pretty much, you know, so much meddling in Colombian affairs for so many years. The New York Times editorial that was published earlier this week, it essentially congratulated U.S. policy for leading to this situation, which to me is mind-boggling. But nonetheless, they did announce earlier this, I guess it was last week, that the U.S. would send a special envoy to the talks in Havana, Bernard Aronson. That sends shivers down my spine, given his track record. What are your thoughts? Because most people were favorable to this, but it seemed to me like kind of a scary consideration.
Well, on balance, I've been favorable to it. I mean, a special envoy to the talks is something that we've been supporting for a while. The reason is we already talked about President Uribe and his political power and the fact that he can rally a lot of opposition. President Uribe is closely associated in Colombians' minds with the United States. In order to counterbalance him, it is great to have the United States make clear at every opportunity that, no, we don't agree with Uribe. In fact, we think these talks are the way to go. Since 2012, every couple months, an Obama administration official will stand up and say something vaguely supportive of the talks, which is good, but we wanted more. We wanted a stronger show of support. And the naming of a special envoy, it makes sense to do that because it means more, you know, it's a real vote of support. Also, there are some things that are going to be discussed in Havana, particularly the extradition orders that the United States has for FARC leaders accused of narco-trafficking, that they can't really resolve on their own. They need to have a U.S. representative there to talk it over. So that's good. I mean, Bernard Aronson was George H.W. Bush's Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America. That is good to some extent because it means that he can talk to Republicans here in Congress who will be throwing up the main obstacles to U.S. support for the post-conflict and peace. It's better to have somebody who can talk to the Republicans. He also is seen as a moderate. It was the Reagan administration that viciously opposed negotiations in Central America when the H.W. Bush administration began. The position shifted to trying to push the El Salvadoran government into negotiations, and Aronson was a big part of that. Mm-hmm. So while we certainly don't see eye to eye, Wola doesn't see eye to eye with Aronson on issues like trade or whether playing Colombia was the right way to go, it's not a terrible choice because of his ability to talk to Republicans here.
Yeah. I think, as you point out in your blog, the Wola, which I'll direct listeners to in a moment, but in the blog you point out that Aronson's private equity firm, which he started up in 1996, has investments in oil extraction projects in Putumayo and Meta in Colombia, two heavy conflictive zones with a large FARC presence. So that must seem at least somewhat of a conflict of interest that could lead to some of the concerns that social movement activists in Colombia have been raising, that the fundamental changes on the ground may not occur subsequent to a peace process. So we're going to continue looking at those developments. Adam, hopefully we can bring you back and others to continue looking at these developments, because it's a story that I still feel is completely underreported in the U.S. Mainstream and even in some of the progressive media that are out there. So thanks so much, Adam, for joining us. Again, Adam Isaacson, Senior Associate of the Washington Office on Latin America, WOLA. He's formerly with the Center for International Policy. He's been covering the Andean region for decades and traveling a lot down there. And you can check out ColombiaPeace.org. ColombiaPeace.org. It's a project of NACLA, and it focuses on, I should say, of WOLA, and it focuses on ongoing development. So it's a very worthwhile site to check out. Thanks so much, Adam.
Hey, thank you, Mario.